We are still in the book of Hebrews, and we finished up chapter 11 last time, where the author went through and talked about faith, and we spent a considerable amount of time discussing faith, and I actually thought it was kind of a good hour. Now, at the beginning of chapter 12, we start off with a therefore, and obviously the therefore takes an antecedent, and the antecedent is all of chapter 11. Okay, so therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witness, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Yeshua, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne. Okay, so again, this is by way of encouragement, as I say, the therefore is hearkening back to all of the examples of faith that are listed in chapter 11, the exhortation obviously being you need to exhibit similar faith as you go through. And then, of course, as the culmination of that list, holding up the Messiah himself as an example of faith. Okay? And the other thing that is talked about in other places, but only mentioned tangentially here, is this idea of reward. And obviously the reward is for Yeshua is the joy of sitting at the right hand of the throne. In other words, he's stepping up and taking his position as the firstborn in heaven. There is also for us reward for steadfastly persevering in faith throughout our lives. It's not really discussed here. Paul describes them as crowns. The Hebrews describe them as a portion in the world to come, but clearly both normative Judaism and Christianity recognize that there is reward for faithful service here in this life. And as we've said in other times and other places, the scales always balance. And what they don't always do is balance in this lifetime. And so what God is saying is the things that you do through faith in accordance with his word very well may not be rewarded in this life. The reward may come in the next, but what he's saying is that it will balance. The other thing that to understand is Yeshua has moved up and is sitting at the right hand of the throne. And remember back in the early part of Hebrews, the writer went to great lengths to demonstrate that we are heirs along with him. So I personally don't expect to sit at the right hand of the throne of God, but as an heir who is an heir with Yeshua to the promises that God has made, I do expect to the extent that I am faithful that God will recognize that and do something with it. Now, as we said this, there's one thing you got to keep firmly in mind. We're not talking about work salvation here. So you've got to keep that differentiated and understand that the price that Yeshua paid to take care of the sin problem is something that he did as a pure gift, and it's not something that you can work to earn. Okay? But having gotten the sin question out of the way through the application of the sacrifice of Messiah, then there are, in fact, rewards for service. One of the problems that we have, Messianic churches in general have, and the Jewish religion has with respect to Christianity, is they think that we are a works-based religion. Okay? That is not true either for us or for Judaism, quite frankly. Judaism quite clearly recognizes that the connection that they make with God the Father is an eternal connection, and that's not something that they can earn. And that once that connection is made, which we would call salvation, once that connection is made, then there is considerable work required to get yourself into a position that you're going to enjoy for eternity, I guess is the easiest way to say that. But in neither case are they assuming that they can work their way into heaven. Verse 3. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood. And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? Remember, now he's referring to the earlier chapters in Hebrews where he has established our kinship with Messiah, and hence our position with respect to God the Father. So what he's now saying is exhorting us as sons. And then, my son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the ones he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which you have all participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. So again, what he's saying indirectly, one of the things we've talked about, is that the whole purpose of the creation that we're in is it's a sorter. And it sorts sheep from goats, wheat from tares, whatever metaphor you want to choose. The whole purpose of this existence that we're walking through is to sort out basically the sheep from the goats. And the other thing to understand is that everything in the natural world, everything that is spiritual is counterintuitive. Okay? So we live in this world, and if you choose to follow the ways of the world, you will in almost every instance be going against what is spiritually required of you. Okay? So, lots of examples. The easy one that everyone can relate to is tithing. Okay? The world says if you have $100 and you give $10 away, you only have $90 and you're poorer for it. Simple arithmetic, right? God says that you'll do better on 90% with me as a partner than you will do on 100% by yourself. Okay? So what God is saying is, my spiritual laws transcend the physical, and your path through this world is designed to give you lots and lots of opportunities to make spiritual choices instead of worldly choices. That's why I say this place is a sorter. It's also a training ground, if you will. That's what the discipline part is training. And as you make choices, God is very gracious and will show you where you have made the wrong choice. He does that with me frequently. And the idea being, the next time you're faced with the same thing, that you will make a better choice, even though in the natural that choice may be unpleasant. And that's the training aspect, is as you walk with God, you learn how he thinks, you learn what his rules are, and you gradually learn to make the choices that are pleasing to him, even when your natural senses tell you that's foolish. And that's the training aspect, okay? So there's both sorting and training going on as we go through the world. And what I'm suggesting that's what's being talked about here in these first 11 verses of Hebrews chapter 12, in addition to the exhortation. I mean, obviously it starts off with exhortation, but now he's explaining much more concisely than I just did, I think, what I just said. Verse 12, therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Strive for peace with everyone, and for the holiness without which no one can see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled, that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears. Okay. A couple of things are going on in here, one of which I want to camp out on a little bit. The first one is, this is addressed to a community. Okay? The Hebrews. And you know, we can speculate what Hebrew community it was addressed to, but the point is it was addressed to a community. And remember, early in the letter, he teed off on them for not being mature in the knowledge of God. And remember the part where he says, you guys should be eating meat by now and you're still drinking milk? And really teed off on them. And so then he went through a lesson, and now at the end of the lesson, he's coming to an exhortation where he's, you know, bucking them up and you know, saying, get back in there. But the thing that's important to understand, one of the things, is that he's addressing this to a community. And he's telling them to take responsibility for each other. Okay? That is in direct contradiction to the prevailing culture in the United States right now. Okay? For example, we have a minority of the population who has a perverted sexual predilection. And they say, it's none of your business. What I do in the privacy of my own whatever is none of your business. We had a president that tried to say that. And the prevailing culture in the United States right now, they got away with it. And that's one of the strong points that the homosexual lobby is pushing on, is it's none of your business. You know, what I do is none of your business. And what the writer of the Hebrews here is saying is, oh yes, it is. Because a community is to encourage, strengthen, discipline, build up, and carry along all of its members. It is not acceptable to have a spiritual superstar in the community that just sort of takes off and you know, goes off like a Paul, and boy, at the end of that, he's, you know, right up there sitting at Yeshua's feet, and boy, look at me, I'm great, but I didn't bring everybody with me. That's not acceptable. And so what he's saying is, you folks need to hold each other accountable. You know, sexual immorality. The other one that I want to talk about is this root of bitterness. And notice that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. I will suggest to you, boys and girls, that the prevailing spirit in the United States right now is bitterness. Look at the debate over the tax cuts. You can't cut taxes because you'll benefit the rich. Okay? Look at virtually any issue in the public life, and it's all centered around envy and bitterness. And what that does, as this letter says, is it causes many to become defiled because bitterness is contagious. In other words, if you're around bitter, resentful people, it's contagious. And we have whole industries that are dedicated to nothing more than spreading bitterness and envy and resentment. The whole trial lawyers lobby, I mean, it's what they make their money off of. Now, anybody remember the Granny Scalding case? Where, you know, this gal fumbling with coffee and sticks it between her legs as she drives away from McDonald's, and the lid comes off and she gets scalded. And they sued. And the line of reasoning was that the amount of money we are asking for here is less than the amount of money that McDonald's makes in one day selling French fries. As if it isn't justice that's important. What's important is this big company has got it. You might just as well take it away from them, the implication being that they have gotten it somehow illegitimately, and give it to this woman who scalded herself. And we read in this week's Torah portion, by the way, that you will not give deference to a poor person in a lawsuit. That's a Torah principle. But do you understand what I'm saying? The whole structure of everything we have is based on bitterness and envy and resentment. They're rich, they're powerful, they got a lot of money, therefore there must be something spiritually wrong with them, and I am justified in ripping them off. And that's what's being talked about here. And that's what the writer of Hebrews is saying, is don't let that kind of a root grow up in your society. And we've done that. And you can, as I say, you can see the results of that. Look at New Orleans. Look at all the stuff that happened among the people that were trying to be helped in New Orleans. No gratitude, just bitterness, resentment. You owe this to me, and not only that, you owe me a whole lot more, and you are somehow reprobate because you didn't give me as much as I think that you should have, and it's nothing but bitterness and envy, fed by the news media, stoked by the news media, egged on by the news media, fomented by the news media.
I agree.
It's the Robin Hood principle run amok.
Well, Robin Hood principle, if it gets started at all, is already amok. The Robin Hood principle is amok by definition. Tee off on that. The comment was that it's a whole Robin Hood mentality. And the fig leaf for that is, in the Robin Hood story, the scenario is set up that the ones being stolen from have themselves stolen it from the people who are going to be the recipient of Robin Hood's largesse. And that's the, you know, the fig leaf, if you will, that gives it legitimacy. While that certainly does happen, it doesn't happen nearly as often as the spirit of resentment would lead you to believe. And again, the spirit of resentment leads you automatically be spring-loaded in, well, if he's rich, there must be something wrong with the way he got it. And that's based on, again, as you say, the Robin Hood myth.
Or if he's rich, he can afford to lose something.
That's the other part of it.
Never any moral high ground when someone's stealing from me to spend it the way they want to spend it.
Yeah, the comment had to do with basically socialist programs and the color of morality that the people who espouse them take. In other words, they say, I'm going to spend it for some purpose that is very worthy, therefore I get to take it from you. I read a quote, and I will bring you the citation next time. And I can't say it precisely, but basically it says that in poor societies, people take care of one another because there's no one else to do it. And as society gets richer, people tend to want to hire people to take care of that function. And the bottom line of that was the ability to preserve life is an individual good. It is not a corporate good. And when you try and take an individual good and make it a corporate good, what winds up happening is you create an evil. Okay? So individual charity, which is to say helping people who need help, is what we're all about. You know, God commands it, we do it. I think if I were to poll everybody, which I'm not going to do, I suspect that most everybody here gives fairly heavily to charities. Mm-hmm. And that's the individual impulse to preserve someone else's life. And that's good and noble. But when you take that individual impulse that is good and noble and you try and hire somebody else to do it for you as a corporate group, it loses. And you wind up creating something that is not good and noble. And that's what we have with socialism.